Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the last full weekend of October 2020. It has been a sunny and a little bit chilly here this week in Sitka, and we even set at least one low temperature record for the date this past week with an outflow event, a pattern, weather pattern more that I associate with winter, especially December and January, and sometimes even into February and March. High pressure over the mainland and winds blowing out of the north and east, cooling things off. But it has been interesting. It's been a little warmer during the days, but chilly at night. Hope you had a chance to get out and enjoy some of the sunshine. A highlight of the week for me was a warbling vireo that showed up at Kessel Hill. It is vagrant season for birds, the peak of the vagrant season, I should say. They can show up any time of year, but this seems to be a time of year when they are especially prone to showing up. If you see an unusual bird, I'd love to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I originally recorded and aired back in December of 2017 with Dr. Sari Robinson of Oregon State University. You can learn more about what she does at northernspalting.com. She is an expert in spalted wood, both working with it as an art and a science. We'll go ahead and join the conversation talking a little bit about what spalting is.
What I know about spalted wood basically fits into the couple of hours of YouTube videos I watched of you speaking to groups of people or individuals about spalted wood. Did a little bit of research, but basically, as I understand it, in its simplest terms, it's wood that gets colored in some way, or color removed, I guess, in the case of things turning white, by fungi that are decomposing.
That is an absolutely great definition.
That's just the,
you nailed it.
The simplest. So and why would anybody care? And I guess that's because it can make really amazing colors, which around here in Sitka, the one that I've seen is Chlorocyborea, so it's the blue wood. And so people hike around. You might notice wood that is stained blue, essentially, kind of a blue-green.
It's a blue-green, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a fungus, basically, that's decomposing. And I don't know why it makes blue.
I can tell you why.
Oh, do you know why? So this is great.
Why. Yeah.
Yes, why does it make blue?
Okay. Just at its most fundamental level, spalting is a form of resource capture. And so the fungi that make the pigments, like Chlorocyborea, elf's cup, which is that blue-green color, a lot of those pigments are antifungal and antibacterial, and they're often produced by fungi that grow very slowly. And so as a method of resource capture, the fungus will secrete the pigment into the wood, thereby holding its resource and giving it time to grow slowly throughout the wood.
I see.
It's a little bit different than, there's another type of spalting, which are the zone lines, and those are the black and brown, sometimes other colored lines you see in decaying wood. And that's another form of resource capture, but that's actually just a melanized wall. So it's a physical barrier instead of a chemical barrier. But at its heart, spalted wood is resource capture.
So we can really essentially, when we see that, we can think, oh, there's little battles going on inside there.
It's
in
war.
A sense. Yeah. So the fact that it's colorful, is there a reason that it's colorful, or is it just sort of an accident of the chemicals that they happen to produce?
I'm not certain that anyone really knows that. I know that in the fungal kingdom, for a lot of instances, color works very differently than with flowers and things like that. With flowers, it's a lot of, attracting pollinators and trying to be attractive. When fungi, we tend to look at pigment as more of a warning system, which is also something you see in the plant kingdom and animals as well. Sometimes you can have color warning, but it's not – with fungi, especially spalting fungi, it's definitely – when I see fungal color, I notice, like, it's probably not super friendly for other –
yeah,
fungi.
Yeah, and I don't really know what's going on in the world of the battles of a chunk of wood, with the different fungi that are colonizing and staking out, that basically laying claim to the resource, as you said. So when the stain moves through, that implies then that the wood, at least in the beginning, there's still stuff there for it to use, and it's trying to kind of spread as quickly as I can to kind of establish its zone, essentially.
Yes.
And then within that, it will eventually
decay. So all of these spalting fungi are different stage colonizers. Mm-hmm. And so the ones that make the white rots and the zone lines, they aren't primary colonizers, but they're pretty quick in there after the airborne molds go through, especially the blue stains go through. They'll take out all the easy sugars in the ray cells of the wood. And then you'll have the decay fungi come through. And those are the ones that can break down the components of wood, the cellulose, the hemicellulose, the lignin, just depending upon the type of fungi and the type of wood. and those will go through, and then they don't strip everything out of the wood. They tend to move on when there's still some structure left to the wood. And at that point, you tend to see the pigmenters on the most decayed wood. They're not, they're a really interesting group of fungi. I consider them sort of like a dead branch that didn't really make it, because it takes so much nitrogen and other fixed nutrients to make that pigment. It's not really a great research capture strategy. And they're slow, slow growing. And so they come in when basically everything else is either not necessarily gone, but not actively attacking anymore. And they get in, and their strategy is, all right, so no one else cares about this wood. I'm just going to make sure that no one else cares about it and lay down all this pigment. And then I can take my time digesting it. It's very rare to see elf's cup, especially Chlorosaboria, on wood that can be used for anything outside of something like marquetry or jewelry.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen, I've found some, it was the most colorful, it was the brightest blue of any that I've noticed, but I just, like, it was just shredded. It's basically, when I picked it up, it was just shreds, essentially.
That's very common, and that's the reason that spalted wood, you know, historically was used for marquetry and intarsia work in Europe, is because it was, what do you do? You have this beautiful turquoise-colored wood, and you want to use it, but you can't, you can't build a house out of it. There's not enough of it. You can't make, like, a lamp out of it. Like, it's not going to stay together. So what do? You take very thin pieces of it that you can stabilize with glues, and then you can turn it into marquetry. And for people who aren't familiar with that, that's where you take really tiny pieces of wood and you glue them up to make a greater overall image.
So it's the kind of the wood version of mosaicing.
Yeah.
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 Okay. So it's occurring to me that there's a little bit of a story here that maybe I don't have the full picture of. We start with a tree that makes the wood. Pathogenic fungi can colonize while the tree's still alive and actually kill the tree. But the tree has its defenses. In the center of the tree is the heartwood, which is no longer active. Maybe they're like, there's not,
the heartwood is dead.
Dead. Okay. Mm-hmm. But protected more or less from decay, either by the inherent property, the like in cedar, for example, it's very resistant to decay even
you're
after
talking
it's
about
dead.
Wood extractives,
right?
Yes.
Okay, so chemicals within the wood that discourage fungi and other decomposers, and then there's the outer part, the sapwood, which is alive and stuff is running through there. So when the tree dies, that sapwood stops moving stuff. There's still the materials there, presumably, that are different than in the heartwood. And so what, if I'm understanding you, there's sugars and so forth that are available pretty early on that some fungi or bacteria specialize in, and they come in pretty quickly and they decompose those. And then there's another set of fungi that come in each successive stage, essentially, as the wood breaks down. There's a different group of fungi, and the ones that are making the colors for spalted wood as opposed to the zone lines come in pretty late in the game.
For the most part, they tend to be pretty late in the game. Fungi are a huge kingdom,
right?
And so it's really hard to make blanket statements about it. It's like, you know, we're talking about numerous genera here that are working, but a lot of them, especially elf's cup, which is the one that people tend to be the most familiar with, it's the most widespread, definitely is one of the later stage colonizers.
Okay.
Although, you know, every so often I do see it on stuff that's undecayed. And it's not that it can't decay wood. It's considered a soft rot fungus. So it does produce some enzymes that can actually degrade the cell wall itself. It's just not common. We can do laboratory tests and we can force it to colonize sound wood. And it can do that. But it's in the wild, it just doesn't seem, whether it's competition, whether it's its ability to reproduce or its speed of growth or its ability to compete with higher order fungi, for whatever one of these reasons, it just doesn't tend to do that.
So the common one, again, that we see here is blue. And I remember watching in the videos, you differentiating between the colors, the pigments that fungi produce and the colors that wood might produce on its own. Like, I mean, as a simple example here, something that isn't at all persistent though, is red alder. You know, when you cut red alder, it turns that bright orange color essentially. And that's something that the tree does on its own. It tends to stay that color for too awful long, but that's not, and I know there are other species of trees that do other kind of build in their own staining or coloring it for one reason or another. But that's not the same as spalting.
That's correct. A lot of trees, I mean, all trees have some type of, you know, immune system like humans do. They have defenses. And in a lot of trees, they use pigments as well. Because those pigments are antifungal and antibacterial, and they use them to section off areas of the cambium from attack from insects and fungi and bacteria and any other types of damage. And it's especially prevalent in maples, and so box elder, which is Manitoba maple, sugar maple has a green pigment that it releases. Manitoba maple / box elder has a very well known sort of bright red pink that it releases as well. And so people can often get confused about those, because if you get a piece of fresh cut wood, the color is very bright. The big difference, of course, is that tree colors they oxidize, and they're not light stable either. And so they fade over time, and fungal pigments, the ones from spalting fungi specifically, do not fade over time. Just because of their roles in the environment. In trees, it's meant to be an internal process. There's no reason for the tree to produce something that's light stable and doesn't oxidize because it's inside the tree. Whereas with fungi, these things are produced on downed dead wood. And so it has to persist in rain. It has to persist in light. It has to persist, you know, for decades while the fungus has a chance to grow through the wood.
Yeah, and I was curious about that. So the light fastness, you know, of course, that's a big, you know, if you do photography or whatever and do inkjet printing or any kind of printing, you know, it's like, well, how long is the picture going to last? And I think probably most of us have seen a faded picture, or even just, you know, if you put something up on the wall that a kid made or something, and the construction paper that was used after a few months, and you look on the backside of it, it's a very,
right,
very different color already. And so light fastness is a challenge, as best I can tell. Like it's UV is pretty... my understanding is it's mostly UV anyway, is pretty damaging of pigments. But so these fungi, in a sense, it sounds like have figured out a way to avoid having their pigments that are not susceptible in the same way to that sort of degradation.
Right. And they will degrade. I don't want to give the impression that they'll never degrade. They're just a lot more resistant to it. They're particularly very stable in indoor light, which is a big deal for artwork in particular. Again, all the old marquetries, you know, from the 1400s on. When you look at them, if you go to the museums now and look at them, you can see the blue-green of the Chloris arboreus still there, and the rest of the work tends to be wood-colored. Well, a lot of them weren't wood-colored. They were dyed. With all these different types of colors, and those have all faded, even under careful preservation, usually in museum basements, even without light, and they faded. And we can tell what color they used to be because, you know, when you restore them or you go to do any type of upkeep, you can take sort of the panels off and you can look at the backside of the marquetry, and you can see all the lovely colors that are still there. And it's only the Chloris arboreus is stable.
Interesting. So it's like peeling that poster off the wall and looking at, oh, look at all that fancy color. Yeah.
But it's rough for woodworkers because if you don't know what to look for, like tree colors tend to appear around areas of wounding or stress, branch stubs.
Yeah.
With box elder especially, you can go and you can take a drill and you can drill little holes in the tree. And then when you cut it down the next year, all of those areas where the holes are will be bright pink.
Wow.
But it gets woodworkers a lot because they don't necessarily know what to look for, and then they will go and they will buy wood and they'll spend a lot of money for something they think is spalted, which ends up being something like box elder, and they turn it and it's beautiful and they put it in a gallery and the gallery thinks it's beautiful and the gallery puts it in a window, and what used to be, you know, bright red is brown in 3 weeks, or they sell it to someone who keeps it in their house away from outdoor light, but even in indoor light and with oxidation it slowly turns brown. And, you know, maybe you paid $2,000 for this beautiful vase and now it's brown and you're angry.
Yeah, that would be a little disappointing, mm-hmm. I'm sure. So it is, so the spalting in particular, I suppose you develop, I mean, an eye for it, essentially, you know what to look for. I'm sure it helps to know the species of the wood that you're dealing with. But what is it, I mean, how is it that you can tell other than sticking it out in the light and seeing what happens?
It's mostly about how the color is in the wood. Again, if it's around an area of wounding at all, chances are it's probably from the tree. There's some colors that trees just don't make. You're not going to see the blue-green of Chloris arboreus anywhere else. That's, mm-hmm. if you see that color, it's spalting. Zone lines, there are a lot of trees that make zone line type things. Those can be a little bit more difficult to tell, but fungi grow in pretty specific ways. And so if you see coloring wherein, say, the rays, which are the cells in wood that run radially out, instead of most cells in wood run up and down, and some of them run in and out for conductive transport that way. And the rays are also sort of the tree's lunchbox. It's where it stores a lot of its sugars. And so, of course, they're target number one for any fungus because the sugars are free and they aren't bound into something else. So they're very easy to get to. And so any fungus is not going to want to spend its time making enzymes and all of these things to digest wood cell components when there's free sugar just hanging out. And so what you tend to see, especially in early stage colonized wood, is color in the rays. And so you'll see if when you look at grain, you're used to the grain running a certain way, and sometimes you can see color running 90 degrees to the grain, and those are the ray cells, and that's where the fungus has gone in and just eaten out all the free sugar. And that's really common to see in spalted wood, is that you'll see color streaks that are running 90 degrees to the long axis of the stem, and then it's very clear that's from spalting.
Interesting. Yeah, it's the things that I don't know about wood fill many books, I'm sure. It's always fascinating to learn a bit more. So I was not familiar with the sort of the rays as cells even that are going through there. And so this, you know, it's still fascinating to me just think about how the tree is growing. And of course, it's made to grow strong. And so, you know, these cells and so forth and that are in there, it doesn't want those to break down very easily. And so it's a lot of work for the fungus to do that. So, but these other cells that you're talking about that where they store the sugars, you know, it makes sense that then, you know, that's the easy part. So they colonize, do they then, is that a different species is making that color? Or will they then, once they get the easy stuff, colonize into the wood around that?
Well, that's a tricky question. There are lots of fungi, the primary colonizers, especially when people say something like mold, they're usually talking about these early stage colonizers, the things that are in the air all the time and that just land. And in fact, if you know anyone or if you work at a lumber mill, you're very familiar with blue stains. And they're a big problem with freshly cut timber because you can cut timber one day and it will be completely blue, not the blue green of Chlorosaboria, but like a gray blue or a slate blue the next day. And that's from airborne Ceratocystis and Ophiostomatoid fungi, which are in the air all the time. But a lot of these molds, the penicilliums, the aspergilluses, do not have any ability to degrade wood for the most part, and so they get on the wood and they can eat the free sugar, but they can't really get inside the wood, and so they're just a surface coloration, so they're not considered spalting. And then once they've gotten what they can get, they sporulate or they move however they want to, and they leave. And then you have the next sort of wave that comes in. And those tend to be, but not always, of course, the decay fungi that will then move through. And they will, of course, then first go to any of the missed sugar, but they can actually degrade cells. And so they will go in and they will secrete their enzymes and they will digest cell wall components. And then that will get them into another area of rays where they can eat that and then continue digesting.
Oh, I see.
Their way
so they're
through.
Kind of like mining, essentially.
Yeah, they're just going to keep going because they're not going to do work that they don't have to do.
Right.
So it's not like they're going to ignore free sugar in a ray cell just to take out a cell wall.
Yeah.
Especially with like no fungus really wants to degrade lignin. I feel like I'm anthropomorphizing them right now, but I'm going to do that. I don't think that any of them like secretly in their heart of hearts are like, I really want to take out lignin.
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to get to the other
that's
stuff.
That's what you can do. So, you know, I'm generally familiar with, or I should say I'm familiar, at least in principle, with two general types of decay, one white rot and one brown rot. And around here, mostly I see brown rot, which, you know, if you look under a tree especially where a tree has grown over, you know, an old log or a stump, you know, the remains of that are just, sometimes it just ends up being dust, but earlier on it's cubes, you know, kind of brown cube sort of things. And then every once in a while, it seems a little less commonly, I see the white rot where it actually ends up just looking like, paper fiber or something, you know, just lots of fiber, but you can stick your finger through it. It's just super soft. And my understanding of that is that they're attacking different parts of the cell structure, essentially.
This is correct. And the reason you see mostly brown rot up here is because you have a lot of conifers.
Okay.
And brown rots are pretty adapted to conifers. White rots tend to grow on hardwoods. Brown rots tend to grow on conifers, although they can certainly swap if they're, you know, bored, I guess.
Right. Well, I've seen every once in a while I find one where there's like where there's a section that of rotten log cut and there will be part of it's white and part of it's brown. And so you see the kind of crosshatch, you know, the cross is where the cube beam kind of thing is happening, and then you see the white mash of fiber.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's kind of, but as presumably they're also competing at some level, and are they attacking totally different things?
Well, so the fundamental difference is what they're attacking, and brown rots can digest everything except the lignin. And the lignin is that slightly pigmented area of the wood cell wall. It's brownish. And that's why when you see brown rot, it's like the fungus has eaten all the flesh and left the bone.
I see.
And it's crumbly without any structure to hold it together. Whereas the white rots are capable of degrading all the cell components, but their key hallmark is that they degrade lignin. And so what you tend to see in white rots is the flesh without the bone. And so they're opposites of one another. But those aren't the only kinds of rot either. Right. Those are the two big ones for basidiomycetes, but there's also soft rots, which aren't – some of them are basidiomycetes, but a lot of them are ascomycetes, which is a different classification of fungi. And they do selective degradation. They're loosely considered to be less evolved than the basidiomycetes. I'm sure that the phylogenetic tree will change tomorrow and everything will be different. But they're all different, but they select very specific areas of the cell wall to degrade instead of sort of this mass degradation. They're just, you know, they're sort of quote unquote not as good.
Or they're a little more specialized.
They are, maybe. But that's where you get, that's where all these pigments come from. These pigments are all soft rot fungi. And that's why they're relatively rare, because again, it's just not, it's not a great overall strategy. The mass pigment secretion and the slower growth and not really having the right enzymes to take out the wood. Just poorly suited for their job, but they make do.
Right, they're still around, and so that's interesting. The Chlorocyborea, the elfin cup that we've been talking about, that's an ascomycete.
It is, yes.
Yeah, so it's a kind of a little cup fungus there, and so they essentially, if you're seeing brown rot or the white rot, then probably you're not going to find the spalted, just because those things happen faster. And outcompete the spalting or just take it over?
They are types of spalting. They are considered types of spalting. They're just, if you can tell that they're brown rotted or white rotted, it's not going to be of much use to you anymore.
I see.
It's those early stages that can do really nice things. And so if you get white rot early, when it's just sort of pocketed the rot, mm-hmm. or it's just done a couple of streaks through the wood, you can have really nice color contrast, like especially on something like a walnut or something dark, and you can see it. There's one... Right now, there's only one species of brown rot that's used for spalting, and it's Fistulina hepatica, which is beefsteak fungus. And that's, if anyone out there is familiar with English brown oak, that's what makes English brown oak brown, because that fungus actually secretes a brown pigment. Of course, if you let it go too long, you get crumbly brown oak. But that's one of those things that's very popular in England. It's a very traditional furniture wood to use. And I would say 95% of the people who use it just think that it's an oak species, that there's just some brown oak out there that magically gives you brown wood, when in fact it's an oak tree infested with Fistulina hepatica.
Interesting. So, I mean, what I'm getting the impression here that there's shall we say, a window of opportunity to have wood that is spalted, but not useless from a doing something with it standpoint.
This is very correct. Yeah. Spalting is just early decay.
Yeah.
It's before it's mush.
Right.
Or powder.
And so how much of, I mean, I suppose it depends on the, you know, tropical rainforest. You probably have a much shorter window than, you know.
And it depends on the wood species, too, because some wood species have a lot more extractives, and that's what makes them mm-hmm. more durable. So the window for something like cedar is much longer than the window for something like birch, that you look at birch and it's a pile of goo on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. So I imagine as you work with this, and you know, part of what's interesting to me about your story is you started this not from the science side, but from the art and craft side of just really being fascinated with wood and working with wood. And from that perspective, I suppose it's really important to start to get develop an eye and a sense of, okay, when is this, I mean, like, here's this chunk of wood. Is it going to be useful to me? Would it be better if I left it a week, or do I need to take it in now? And all of those kind of questions. I suppose there's a lot of just experience that will inform your decisions about whether a given piece of wood is likely to be, you know, when you're past that window, or whether you should let it go a little more.
I think it's a combination of experience and education. I've been working with spalted wood pretty routinely since I was about 16, and I was introduced to it in high school woodshop. And you know, I turned it for years and years before I moved into wood science, because I did my undergraduate in woodworking and specialized in wood turning, and I worked with spalted wood there. And I got a feel for it, but I wouldn't say that I really understood it as a material. And I think that can be true of many, many wood turners. You can work with it a lot, but fungi are so variable that until you really get an understanding of what the fungi are doing to the wood, it can be really hard to interpret what you're going to see in the final piece. And now that I've gone through, I've done my master's and my PhD, postdoc, and I'm a professor now, and I spend a lot of time working specifically with certain fungi, it gets a lot easier for me to pick up a piece of wood, look at it from a wood turner's perspective, and say, this is how it has to be mounted, this is how the grain is going to be oriented, and I know this is how the tool is going to hit the wood. But with my mycology background, I know that this is how the fungus grew into the wood. So if the tool hits it at this angle, it's going to blow up, whereas if the tool hits it at this angle, it's not going to blow up.
Oh, I see. So you've developed then through your experience and learning about the mycology, as well as your experience working with the wood, essentially the structural effects of the decay, and that in some ways in that the way that a given fungus tends to decay the wood will make it weak in certain ways faster than other ways, and then you can work with more wood that way, essentially without having it blow up in your face when you're turning.
Correct. I find that having done a master's and PhD in wood science was very useful. And I would recommend it to any woodworker, at least taking some classes on wood science, because you can't truly understand the material and truly be a master of it without some fundamental understanding of its structure. And now some people can gain that through time working with the material. And there are plenty of masters, you know, who've been at it for 50 or 60 years who have a very intense understanding of the material. But It's you know, sometimes a book is just really helpful to go right in and look at, well, when we put wood on the lathe, why do we mount it the way that we do? Mm-hmm. When they say to use a scraper versus a bull gouge or a skew chisel, why do we do that? What is the difference in angle? Why is using a skew chisel so hard for some people, but why does it make a better cut? Like, you can answer those questions if you know how the tree is growing and what the fibers and the vessels actually look like. And I think it takes a lot of the learning curve out of woodworking, especially wood turning, because you don't have to sit there and spend hours upon hours upon hours touching and feeling the wood, which you should do anyway, but it takes out a lot of the mysticism and adds in the, oh, okay, so my tool jumped, and let me look at the angle, let me look at how the wood is oriented, I understand why that happened, and now it's not going to happen again.
Yeah, it makes sense to me that it's basically giving you tools to understand what's happening and not have to essentially learn from scratch,
right,
based on long, long experience of, oh, this is a pattern that I keep see occurring repeatedly, you know, as opposed to an accident of this chunk of wood. Whereas when you have some models or principles about how the wood forms and the structure of it and the strength of it, that gives you a context in which to put any given thing that happens, I suppose, and learn more quickly.
Right. I mean, this is something that I feel really passionate about, this blend of understanding material that you are with in terms of an art standpoint. And so when I got hired on at Oregon State, it was mostly, I mean, I think it's entirely wood scientists of varying forms. And then they hired this artist, and I was very quickly sort of out of place. And I ended up starting a new option within the major called art and design. And what I'm trying to build there, we've been running it for a few years now, it's been wildly successful, is running the students through a lot of the traditional wood science classes, wood anatomy, wood chemistry, wood physics, but then also putting them in art studio type classes. So they take 2D structures, 3D structures, but then they get to work in our wood shop, and they have to use, we expect a lot out of them. We expect them to understand, you know, just fundamentally going in, you know, what's the difference between a crosscut and a rip? What's the difference? You know, why do we cut this way? Thinking about the anatomy. When they take my wood turning classes, these art and design students, we talk a lot about how are we mounting it on the lathe? Why are we mounting it on the lathe? When we do something like wet turning, one of the big projects I have them do is you have to make a lidded box out of a wet branch wood. And you have to make it so that when it dries, the lid fits snugly. And there's math involved with that. And then they have to sit there and go through their charts. All right, what type of wood is this? What's the shrinkage rate? This is juvenile wood. Let me look that up. Let me see what the actual dimensions are that I have to turn it. So that they're learning form and they're learning function and they're learning artistic style, but they're doing it in a way that they really get the background of the material.
Yeah, it seems like that would be a really great way to kind of weave those together, you know. And you sounds like you started, you know, you got that experience more in graduate school, but started from the artistic craftsman side of you know, just building things, basically creating things on the lathe. Sounds like mostly you work with the lathe.
Yes, definitely prefer wood turning. I did a lot of furniture in high school.
Okay,
and then my woodshop teacher in high school like convinced me that I needed to try wood turning. We had done some spindle work before, and I just was not a big fan of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he brought in this piece of box elder wood, which is streaked with the red, not spalting, of course, but still very beautiful. And I was just like, what is this thing that you like? You did not tell me that there was neon pink wood. Had you led with there is neon pink wood in the world, I think there would not have been any battle whatsoever.
Yeah.
And once I turned that, I'm an impatient person, and the quick turnaround in wood turning, I think, sucks a lot of people in. You know, 20 minutes, you can go from a log to a finished piece is intoxicating.
Well, you know, there's a local person who I think you're going to meet here, Zach, who I've spoken to, and one of the things that he talks about with the turning is really getting a sense of the wood and where it came from, like the tree that it came from, the story in that tree, by being able to, like the third dimension of it. You know, it's not just the flat surface, but you see as you move through the bowl and you uncover things, you know, it's just so fascinating as well.
Spalting's like that too. When you're turning spalted wood, especially if you're doing a hollow form or something that's got an interior and walls, you can see how the fungus has grown, because you'll see sort of its track pattern as you move through the wood. And that's really neat too, because especially if you're doing any type of coring where you have multiple bowls from the same piece, you can watch, you know, here in layer one was the initial stage where it entered. Here's layer two where it started spreading. Here's layer three where it encountered some other fungus, and there's a line here. And they all tell these really neat stories.
Yeah, it seems it is kind of fun to imagine those and the timescales over which those happen. And I'm sure that depends on the location and the species of wood, you know. Could be pretty slow or it could be pretty fast. But you mentioned the lines before, the zone lines.
Yes.
And that those are if I remember your words, it was a melanistic wall or something like that.
The black and brown ones are generally melanin.
Okay, melanin. So, and those are essentially just barriers, essentially the fence, basically.
They are, yes. Yeah. They're a physical barrier.
And when we see them, they'll tend to be like oval shaped or whatever kind of shape.
Not necessarily.
Mostly
they're lines.
Oh, okay. Just go through.
Yeah, like, they come in a lots of different thicknesses. Some fungi just make a big melanized mat.
Mm-hmm.
Some make lines. You can see the circular ones, but that tends to be a different type of deal. The lines are very much fungus A meets fungus B, and they just delineate territory. The circles you tend to get, now of course not always, because there are some that just make circles. But the circles tend to be more of a walling off effect. And so if you have one that's slightly less aggressive than the other, then you're going to have one that gets completely captured in a circle by the other, and then may choose to hop, whether it's through sporulation or there's another part of it. But that tends to be a complete walling off instead of just a fence.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I mean, I guess when I've run into it, it's been in whole wood primarily, and I've seen it on the surface of a log or whatever, and it's been some of them have been more like patches, if you will, which presumably aren't patches all the way through, but that's just like a layer, and then others have been ovals and shapes. I'll pull up a picture later, and I'll have that picture on with when I post the show on my website, but and I'll show you just a picture that I took of a log on the beach, essentially, that just had all these black. It was just this really, to me, it was an abstract pattern, essentially. A pattern's probably not the right word, but an abstract kind of thing. You're looking at it, you're not really sure necessarily what it is, except for you can tell it's wood more or less, but why it turned that way. And I don't usually see that here. You know, mostly it's like you were describing, the brown rot or the white rots. And one of the things that I know that you've worked on, because I saw you talk about it on YouTube, was controlling the rot, essentially controlling inoculating wood to essentially have the species of interest as opposed to ones that are going to degrade it more. And then incubating, I don't know if that's the right word, but incubating that wood, then taking care of it in such a way that fosters the fungal growth, and then stopping that growth at a certain time when it's hopefully, you know, optimal for whatever you're going to use it for. So I was just curious to hear a little bit about how that works.
Right. Controlled spalting is incredibly easy. What you can do at home, and we do it in the lab, is we take wood. It's actually a lot easier to work with kiln-dried wood because, mm-hmm. in theory, there's nothing alive on it except for some airborne molds. As long as the wood is dry, most things are dead. And so you get kind of a blank canvas. But if you're working with green wood, so freshly cut wood, there's a lot of stuff already living in there that can interact with your fungi. But once you get it, your wood, you can select what fungi you want based upon what kinds of types of spalting you want. Mm-hmm. And then you can inoculate them. You literally just put the live forms of the fungi, and that's not the fruiting form. I think that's really important for people to understand, is that fruiting forms are made for spore dispersal. And yes, they have hyphae and they have those kinds of things, but it will save you a lot of time if you actually just have the actively growing form, so something in a petri dish that you can buy from various places. And put that directly on the wood instead. There's also fungi colonize other fungi, and so just because you have a mushroom, one, doesn't mean that it's a spalting fungus. Not all mushrooms spalt. And two, you can't guarantee that that mushroom that you picked up has any spores left, or that the spores it does have are from it.
Yeah.
So if you work with monocultures, once you buy, you're a lot better off. And you can put them on the wood, and then you mostly just keep it wet. There's a moisture content game you have to play that's a little bit different depending upon what type of spalting you're trying to do. And as long as you keep it in a relatively tight, controlled environment, not too cold, of course. I tend to do it in my bathroom, which I realize just disturbs a lot of people. In my old apartment, I used to have these old radiators, and I'd get those plastic tubs from Walmart.
Right.
And I'd put it on top of the radiator. And then when I was showering, I would take the lid off to get a lot of moisture in there. And then when I was done showering, I'd put the lid back on. If you don't want to put it in your shower, you can just water it like you would a houseplant. Not that often.
Yeah.
You want to run somewhere between like 30 and 50% moisture content. But cycling is really important because happy fungi don't spalt, generally speaking. These are things happen in response to stress. There's no reason for Elf's Cup to make that blue-green color if there's nothing trying to get it. Like, why would it do that? It's very expensive for them in terms of nutrients and input in order to secrete pigment. And so you need to make their lives not super hospitable. You don't want to kill them, but you don't want them to be really relaxed either. And so you've got to really walk that tightrope. And so cycling it, going from low moisture to medium to high and then back again, can be really beneficial in terms of spalting. But yeah, it's not that hard. In most hardwoods, under controlled conditions, if you're using white rot fungi, you're looking at about 12 weeks, which is a lot faster than it would happen in the wild.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. I guess it's not really surprising, but so many things have the ability to, go into a cyst form or some form that allows them to go dormant for a while. And so it's interesting to me that it sounds like the fungi don't, at least where it comes to drying. Like if you dry something, then that just actually kills it. And if you get it wet again, it's not coming back.
Well, the fungi can certainly go dormant. Mm-hmm. The spores and a lot of species, I'd say probably, they can persist forever.
You can
dig them out of Arctic ice and rehabilitate them, and they will come back. The thing is that a lot of fungi don't produce spores inside of wood because spores are generally moved with the air. And
right.
So
they need to be, yeah.
Yeah. Like adaptively, fungi do not produce spores inside of wood. That's not something that you see. And so, there's definitely a vocal minority in the wood turning community that's deathly afraid of spalted wood, and they're afraid of spores. The thing is, of course, there's no spores inside the wood. And so if you have a piece of wood and you've turned it, you've turned off the outside. And so all that's left then are the filamentous parts, the hyphae of various forms. And those are very fragile. And so you take away the water and things just die.
Yeah. Interesting. And then, of course, the pigments aren't really the fungus.
No, they've been secreted.
They're
secretions.
All right.
You can think of them as fungus vomit if you'd like to, but they're not all of them. Now the blue stains, which are the ones that are the primary colonizers, that slate blue mm-hmm. kind of color, those can also be bound within the hyphal cell wall.
Okay.
There's a couple of different types of those. But for the most part, the chlorosiboreas, the cytolidiums, those greens and pinks, they are actually just secreted outside the cell wall. And so even if you, like, if you have a piece of wood, a big, let's say a 6x6x6, like a fairly decent sized chunk of wood, just because an area is stained blue-green doesn't necessarily mean that there's even a fungus anywhere near there, because the pigment is secreted and does move through the wood with the wood's water. And so you could very well have pigment in an area that the fungus never reached.
Oh, interesting. So, you know, one of the things that I've noticed here, especially we have a lot of hills around and trails along the hills, and then people will cut.
Hills, is that what you call them?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, some of them. Some of them are mountains. But where we hike often, it's a little bit of a hill, and they'll cut a log that's fallen across. And then at that cut end, you'll see what I guess it's just stuff that's moving through the wood. That, I mean, I'm not sure what else, but in principle, what you're saying is that if there was a fungus that was staining up further, it would basically just run downhill through the fibers of the wood along with water and other things that are
the pigment might, you know, yeah. Fungi all run in very different ways. Mm-hmm. Not all, of course, have the ability to move through wood. And some of them, like especially the soft rots, may preferentially move radially instead of longitudinally. The decay fungi inevitably end up running longitudinally as they go down the cell. And so it's such a big kingdom in comparison to that. But it's if you have a log and you cut it in half, you can definitely see community dynamics. There's always a lot more spalting happening, or decay in general, at the ends, because that's the input. That's where it comes from. Bark is very good at protecting wood from, you know, vectors. And so at the ends, you usually see a lot of spalting, and then you'll see it peter out as you move closer towards the center.
Huh. Yeah, it is kind of fascinating to think about this world of rotting fungi in the logs, which can be large, you
yes.
know, and take, you know, around here, decades, really. I mean, they are probably not going to be very useful in most cases, unless it's cedar, after a few years, because the brown rot seems to go through pretty quickly. But there's still enough there, like you're climbing over them for many years, especially if they're up off the ground, I guess.
Right. Well, any wood in ground contact is going to decay much more quickly, because there's just so many fungi.
Oh, like, in the ground, right.
Well, and, you know, you got to think of spores land. Mm-hmm. They aren't. Fall is a great time for spores in the air, because a lot of the fungi are dropping their spores. But, you know, where do those spores go? They can last forever, so where do they go? And you're going to find a lot of them, you know, end up in the ground. They end up stuck to other things. Fungi, and there's a lot of moisture in the ground. And, of course, water is a big fundamental element of decay. And so wood that's not in ground contact doesn't stay as consistently wet, doesn't have the same access to microorganisms that wood in ground contact does.
And are there – I know that sometimes – well, wood that's underwater, essentially, constantly will tend not to decay as fast. You know, buried in a muskeg
right.
here, for example, anaerobic conditions. Are there fungi that work very slowly in those conditions and
no,
create
fungi,
spalting?
No, fungi require oxygen.
Okay, so they...
And so you do not get fungal decay when there is no oxygen,
which
is why you can use that timber that's brought up from shipwrecks. It's got microbial damage from bacteria,
mm-hmm.
but it's usually pretty sound.
All right. And there aren't bacteria that create staining in
there are certainly bacteria that stain. Do they create penetrating stains? No.
Okay,
and that's
so they're
always,
on the surface.
That's
yeah.
that's the huge distinction. There are so many fungi, just so many, that create pigments. And so it's really important to separate them out between ones that create penetrating pigments
okay.
and the ones that don't. Especially in terms of things like stability. If they're just meant to color the surface, then they're not going to have that same durability. The color's not going to be as durable because there are different ecosystem niches. In terms of toxicity, a lot of people have allergies to a lot of those airborne molds. They're not inherently toxic, which is one of those big urban legends that keeps boxing around. So the penicilliums, the aspergilluses, are not just going to flat out kill you, but they are very irritating just because of their spore load. And so spalted wood often gets a bad rap because people see, well, that wood is fuzzy and green and I turned it and I had to go to the hospital because I got like some nasty infection in my, I don't know, or they had an allergy attack or something. But that's not the spalting. That could be anything. That could be bacteria on the surface of the wood. Wood dust itself is a major human carcinogen. Sometimes you've just turned it one too many times without a mask.
Yeah.
And
I would imagine that
body's just done.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, you see the big shavings, but I imagine there's a lot of dust.
It's
as
the
well.
Stuff you can't see
yeah.
that's dangerous, all that really fine particulate
that
and
goes deep into your
woodworker's
lungs.
Lung is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of older woodworkers refuse to wear respiratory protection. And it's a lot like smoking. You can die at 105 having chain smoked your entire life. and be fine and not die of lung cancer, or you can get lung cancer at 30 and die. It's one of those things that it accumulates, and it can affect you.
Yeah. I've heard people talk about cedar in particular being basically developing allergies to it, or even developing allergies to the bryophytes that tend to grow on the
outside. Cedar's a very toxic wood, and it's something that, along with things like walnut, that people just don't want to deal with. And I think it's because we've had a big push towards, you know, natural is better, and people forgetting that nature has its own defense system. And so just because it's natural, that doesn't make it safe. And so I see a lot of cedar being used in interior housing now without being finished because people like that smell. Mm-hmm. Well, that smell is an aromatic extractive, and that smell is there to kill things. That is its job, and it's there to kill a lot of things in the animal kingdom. That's why we use it for cedar chests. That's why moths die, because that smell is toxic. And I mean, for years, people thought that small pets like guinea pigs and things like that had a very short lifespan, that they were like a one-year kind of animal. They have very long lifespans, but people were keeping them on cedar chips, and that smell kills animals. And we're much larger organisms, but it's still very dangerous to us. And people now, like, they put it on the insides of their homes, and they're constantly breathing it in. It can damage your sinuses. Now, of course, there's lots and lots of different species, and they're not toxic, but that smell is very indicative. And it's the same things with, people don't think about woods that are dark colored. A lot of those dark colors are from extractives. Things like walnut, which has toxic extractives. They're not aromatic. It's not the smell, but they do move with water. And so when you have things like cooking spoons, cutting boards, or children's teething toys, especially, people are going away from using paints on children's toys, which is laudable, but then they still want color. And so they'll use a maple for white, they'll use a cherry for red, and they'll use a walnut for a brown or black for teething toys. But it's got toxic extractives, which are water soluble, and you're putting it in your child's mouth. And it's just one of those, you gotta think a little bit before you use wood.
I guess part of it is it's slow. So it's not something that just necessarily
and
hits
things
you right
that
away.
Affect children don't affect adults a lot of the time. And so, you know, a walnut cutting board for an adult, I mean, we're so big, and it's such a small amount of extractives. Who cares?
Right.
But when you start looking at applications for children, that's where a lot of things start stumbling. Or large applications, like you do a whole house interior. Mm-hmm. That's when things start getting, problematic.
Wow. Yeah, I had never really thought about that for wood. But it makes sense. Like, cedar is what I'm most familiar with here. I know, you know, pine has a lot of pitch in it, and that seems to be the thing that it uses for defense more.
Right.
But yeah, cedars, it's a smell that I find becomes overpowering. Like, I like the smell when I'm walking around, but if I were in a confined space with it, I would find it unpleasant pretty quickly, I suspect. And then I suppose that's probably why it's my body's saying, you know, this isn't really great.
Right.
You know?
And it's so interesting because people have gotten really into, especially with the essential oil craze that's going on right now, a lot of those are taken from tree extractives of various forms. And some of them are perfectly fine, but there's a lot that use various cedar oils or things from junipers, the false cedars. And I just have so many concerns about them. You know, it's one thing, you know, you have a bathroom and you're burning a cedar scented candle and you're an adult, you know, you have a bathroom fan you can turn on. It's the chances of any actual damage being done to you is relatively low. I mean, over time, if you burned it every day for 20 years, we might be talking about something. But then you start, there are things like these diffuser necklaces that nursing mothers will wear, that you have a little ball and you put an essential oil in that's right next to your nursing child's face, or fiddle necklaces or teething necklaces that are meant to be chewed on, that they make out of juniper woods and cedar woods. And then again, that's a really big issue.
Yeah, that's, you know, again, it's not something I would have necessarily thought about, but I suppose with your, you know, your work both in the sort of material science of wood and then also just, you know, the mycological side of it as well, where, you know, you're seeing firsthand the effects of these ongoing, you know, evolutionary battles, essentially about, you know, both sides trying to live, basically. And kind of escalating their arms race, if you will, and you know, no, they're not really worried about us per se. You know, we're not really relevant to their world, probably in this realm. But that doesn't mean that those chemicals and the sort of the warfare that they're going through there don't have impact on us.
Right, and it's important to think about how the kingdoms are structured, and a lot of these whether it's a tree extractive or whether it's a fungal secondary metabolite, the fungi in particular tend to be more concerned about other microorganisms. But trees, a lot of their warfare and their strategies are also against insects. Insects and animals, you know.
Right. And grazers too, I suppose.
Right, yeah. So think about the kingdom structure. It seems like we're very far from insects, but we're not so much, like in terms of the whole evolutionary tree. And so if it's effective against insects, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be effective against us. But it means that there's a chance.
Yeah.
You just have to kind of think about
that. Maybe, that makes interesting food for thought to just consider, you know, how you – and, you know, I suppose that in the end – if you're really going to be doing a lot of volume of woodworking and stuff, it's a fairly straightforward thing to get a respirator. And
right. There's no excuse to not wear a NEOSH 95 or better respirator when you are woodworking. It's your health. It's like everyone wears safety glasses now. We've finally gotten to the point where everyone puts a pair of safety glasses on. And it'd be great if we could get to a point where everyone also put on a respirator. Because there's plenty of woodworkers out there who have a certain wood species they can't work with anymore because they worked with it too much. Or who have woodworker's lung or end up getting a lot of secondary infections because there's so much wood dust in their body already that other things can colonize.
Yeah, yeah.
This conversation took like a really like 90 degree turn.
Well, that's the way that they go sometimes. It seems like it's kind of an important thing to consider, especially for folks that are out there. And around here, a lot of people, you know, work with wood at least a little bit, you know, firewood and chopping wood. And I'm sure that's a much lower load of those kind of things. You're working outside typically and you know, the chainsaw isn't the same as like turning out bowls for hours, you know, hours and hours each week. But it does seem like an important thing, you know, even as you were saying, considering the wood that's in your home and what it was intended for. I suppose it's easy to get a little overwhelmed and think about, I just have no idea. You know, I don't have any idea about the finishes. They sound like they're bad if I read about those, and the wood itself might not be great.
I mean, if people want a really general guide, any wood that's going to be in mouth or food contact, you just try and get white woods. Mm-hmm. Because color indicates extractives a lot of the time.
Okay.
And so anything that's darker colored is, chances are, has extractives in it. And they may be perfectly benign, mm-hmm. but they may not be. But if it's a white wood, there's just nothing in it. It's just,
right.
it's just wood. So things like maples and birches, those medium density white woods can be really safe. The other thing to remember is if it is wood that's going to be in food contact or mouth contact, try and get something without a finish on it. Mm-hmm. And that's not just because I don't trust finishes. I have actually no problem with finishes whatsoever. But finishes do wear off. The other thing is that wood has this neat antimicrobial property to it, in which wood is hygroscopic and it always wants to be equal with moisture content throughout the whole piece. And so if you get wood wet on the surface, within a few hours, the wood will have pulled that moisture down into it and tried to equilibrate it throughout the wood. And what that means is if you have a wood cutting board and you cut something like raw chicken on it, and then you rinse it, you take a wet cloth, you don't even have to use soap. You just have to get it wet, not dunk it. Now, this is really important. Do not like leave things submerged in water for hours. That's how you get mold. But if you wipe it down with a damp cloth, the water will pull the bacteria down into the wood. It gets trapped in there. It can't move and it dies. And so wood that's unfinished is perpetually clean, given enough time to dry, of course.
Right.
And when you start putting finishes on it, it doesn't hurt the wood, of course, but you inhibit that antimicrobial function, which in my mind is the whole reason to have things like wood cutting boards and wood cooking spoons, is that you don't have to get all concerned about, oh, you know, I just cut raw chicken on this. Where's the E. coli? Like, how, what do I have to put it in the dishwasher? What do I have to do with plastic? Of course, when you cut it, it makes these grooves and you can't really clean them and you end up with all these colonies. But with wood, even after you cut it, because you get it wet, they move down and your wood is clean, which is why you can pass wood cutting boards down for generations. And it's such a phenomenal material to use, but people expect wood to shine, you
right.
know, and they just feel like it's not right unless it's shiny. Well, that shine is a finish. And it's great if it's something you're going to put on your wall or you want it outside and you want it to last. Of course, finishes play a very important role in preventing wood deterioration outside. But inside, especially in mouth or cooking contact, avoiding finishes is definitely the way to go.
Do you have any recommendations for folks that are interested in kind of, I mean, you obviously have a passion for wood, and it's fun to talk to you about it. And but for folks that are kind of interested, maybe they don't necessarily know a lot. Any suggestions for kind of getting started working with wood, learning about wood?
I think it depends on what you want to do. There are lots of wood turning guilds around, mm-hmm. and I've never been to a town that didn't have at least one wood turner in it. Wood turning and woodworking in particular tend to be taught through mentorship systems where you find some older person who teaches you how to do that, putting ads on things like Craigslist. While may not actually get the person themselves, because a lot of older people are not on those kinds of things, often they have a child who is,
right,
and will funnel that back to you. If you just want more information on wood itself, Bruce Hoadley, he has two books called Understanding Wood and Identifying Wood, and they're really basic wood anatomy books. They're very easy to read, and they'll walk you through really sort of the fundamental building blocks of wood and what are extractives, what are the different cell types, and that's really, those are really good primers. If you're interested in spalted wood, there's only one book on
it. And you wrote
it. That would be my book.
Yeah.
And it's just called Spalted Wood. I think the history, science, and art of a unique material, or those words might be slightly mixed up in there. And that will walk you through everything you ever wanted to know about spalted wood, but were afraid to ask. So that is, we start with the really basics. What is it? What does it look like? There's, I don't know, probably 20 pages of color plates that you can go through and look at a bunch of different types of spalting, the history of spalted wood, charting it from the 1200s, how it moved into the United States, what it looks like now, modern spalting, and then there's a section on do-it-yourself spalting in the back.
If a person was so inclined, they could do a little experimentation with spalting on their own just for fun.
I would encourage that.
Yeah. And so just, well, you said kiln-dried wood. So either purchasing something, or if you wanted to, you know, if you were cutting down a tree in your backyard or something, like alder is a better choice.
Alder
than
is a
conifer.
Great wood to spalt because it has like zero decay resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it spalts very quickly. You just have to be real careful with it, because if you want to put zone lines on it, it'll rot really fast.
I see.
So
you
be
have
careful.
To nice thing is it's abundant here, so I guess
right.
I guess if you mess up the first time, go for a little shorter the next time.
We should probably mention just real fast that if you're going to do conifers, they don't take zone lines well, because zone lines tend to come from white rotting fungi.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to do conifers, you need to be looking at the pigments.
Oh, okay. And so there are places online a person can look to find inoculants and
right. I'm pigments. Just going to send them to my website, because we have
okay.
tons of resources there.
Okay.
So that's www.northernspalting, which is just like it sounds. Spalting is spalting.com. And there's downloadable do-it-yourself pamphlets. There's links to plenty of places. We sell the fungal cultures through my lab, but there's plenty of other places you can get them as well. We sell the extractable pigments. So we grow the fungi in the lab and suck their pigments out of them. We collect them, sort of
right.
like you would take honey from bees. And then that saves you all the actual having to put the fungus on the wood part, and you can just take there.
So you just use the pigment on the wood.
It's so fast. I love it. It's amazing.
So you can actually just kind of paint with those
yeah,
pigments.
Yeah, it still moves. It moves in the same way it would if the fungus secreted it, but you can at least make sure it's in one certain area of the wood. But everything that basically you need, you can get on northernspalting.com.
Wow. So this is all very fascinating. I better be careful. I'll get excited and we'll talk for 2 hours. So, I want to thank you for coming in and speaking with me. And if folks are interested, northernspalting.com, you can find all sorts of resources there on spalted wood and wood in general, or primarily just spalted wood.
Spalted wood, but I'm happy to answer any questions all people have about wood.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Dr. Sari Robinson of Oregon State University. She was here in 2017 to give a talk as part of the Natural History Seminar series. You can find out more about the work she's continuing to do at northernspalting.com. I want to thank her for taking some time out of her trip here to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I love to hear what you're seeing out there, and especially this time of year with vagrants around. Please let me know if you see any unusual-looking birds that don't seem familiar. You can email me at sitkanature@gmail.com or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.